Welcome to episode 14 of Girls on Pop. I am Maureen Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
I'm Ashley Lynch.
I like how I do the hand thing, even though like nobody else can see it. I don't know.
You can't see on the radio, but
I just gesticulate. Yeah, I gesticulate a lot.
It's important.
That's right. That's right. So it's been a little while since we recorded, but we're back and we've got thoughts on things.
Yeah, it's a whole new year. It's like we had a Christmas, we had a new year. We are not in 2020 anymore, thank God. And it's like we're in a whole, you know, we may still be in a pandemic, but we're in a whole wacky new adventure of a year.
To you, does it feel different? Does 2021 feel different than 2020 so far?
It does. And it's only because that horrible goblin of a monster is no longer in office that I feel like to a degree, like, even though in many ways the world is still on fire, it's like it feels a little less on fire. And it feels like it's just sapping my emotional well-being less. And I feel better for it. I feel like weights have been lifted off my shoulder.
I could go with that. It's certainly, it's nice not to be glued to CNN like we were before. It's crazy. Like, we used to watch CNN just randomly all the time. Like, after dinner, let's watch CNN. Now it's just like, eh, whatever.
I know. It's crazy. It's like, all of a sudden, like, you know, the scene where, like, everyone is, like, glued to their televisions like slaves. And all of a sudden, TV goes out. And everyone's like, oh, I guess I'll go outside now. There's a whole world out here. That's what it feels like, almost.
Pretty much. It almost, you're totally right. It totally feels like that. So, you know, new world, but same old movie Twitter drama. So you had some interesting news stories that you shared with me. And I kind of heard, I've been so under the weight of everything that I haven't really been tracking what's going on in the movie world for a while. But it's hard to not hear certain things. And one of the things that was the big news when it happened was Gina Carano getting fired from The Mandalorian. I'm actually shocked it took this long.
I am a little bit too. At the same time, I'm not, because technically Gina was not fired from her job. She was just not rehired. You know, they came to the end of season two and Disney decided we are not going to renew her contract. And originally they had planned to have her be part of the big investor announcement meeting. They were even in talks of doing like a spin-off series about her character because her character was doing really well on the show. And as Gina Carano became a increasingly problematic person with an increasingly problematic social media presence, Disney started to distance themselves from her more and more, and they ended up just completely dropping her from that investor meeting. And that led to, okay, once we're out of the woods of season two, just like Gina's not coming back. And they, you know, probably the most distinct thing is they put out a note, a press release basically saying she is not coming back for the remainder of the show, and we have severed our relationship with her. So while she was technically not fired, she just wasn't rehired. That's kind of how you get fired in the film industry. It's just like your phone stops ringing. And people stop asking you to like come to stuff. You don't get invited back to the party. That's how you get fired in film. So it's essentially kind of a firing.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that it took this long, because I mean, it's not the first time that she's made some incendiary comments, and judging from what she's posted over a period of time, this wasn't even the worst thing that she posted. It just seemed like the timing was...
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like it started off, she was posting some pretty transphobic stuff, and then she went into the anti-mask conspiracy stuff, and then finally looped around to, you know, classic anti-Semitism. And it's like, I guess that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And, you know, it's like, finally it was time to remove her from the show. And at this point, Disney has said that they're not actually going to recast the character. So I think it's just going to be that Cara Dune just sort of disappears from the show. It's like, she's off on her own adventure and we'll never see what, you know. Oh, she died in space on her way home. Whatever. It's all good.
Pretty much.
I know there was a big, like, push, and I actually kind of love the idea to like recast the character with Lucy Lawless, because I think she would be fantastic in that role, because I love Lucy so much, and I think that would be great to see her on that show, but Disney has said that they're not going to recast the character.
Come on, John Favreau, you're listening, right? I'm sure he can find a slot in there for Lucy.
She
can make it happen.
They can bring in Lucy Lawless, and she could be playing a character called Dara Brune. That's her character's name. Welcome, Dara Brune. You're a completely different person. Yes, I am. Happy to be here.
We've written the story for you. Just do it now.
It writes itself.
Yeah, just send out the contract. So the fallout from this has been interesting because so she doesn't get the call from Disney. She gets dropped by UTA, which is kind of like a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so how does Ben Shapiro fit into all this? Because all of a sudden she is like all over the Daily, whatever the name of that show is, because I didn't know it even existed.
Okay, so Gina basically, because she's leans right wing, immediately did the whole thing where, like, because the last post that got her fired was basically making a comparison between what it's like to be a conservative in 2021 to what it was like to be Jewish during the Holocaust. And it was like, Disney was having none of that. And so obviously that's her political leanings. And what do you do if you're a right-leaning figure who, you know, is suddenly finds yourself in hot water because you have horrible takes and you're facing consequences for your actions? You blame cancel culture and say that the left is trying to ruin you and everything's out of control. And it's like, these are just ideas and opinions and that sort of thing. So then enter in Ben Shapiro of the Daily Wire, who has basically just started a film distribution wing through his right-wing blog, The Daily Wire, which is really weird to begin with. But what they did was they partnered with a company called Cinestate. Now, Cinestate, which you may or may not know, is a small indie genre production company that got in some hot water last year when it became known that a line producer on most of their films had sexually assaulted an underage girl who worked on one of their movies. And he got arrested for it and convicted. And the company had been covering this up for some time, on top of a whole bunch of other really horrible behavior. And they as well are a right-leaning film company. So they had, by that point, they've been growing, and they bought the website Birth, Movies, Death, and they had bought Fangoria, the relaunched magazine. And the fallout was huge. Birth, Movies, Death ended up closing its doors, and that site is now gone. Fangoria managed to extricate itself, so it is no longer part of Cinestate, and it is its own thing, so they are still surviving. And Cinestate went off to lick their wounds and rebuild their company. And one of the things that they did was they purchased a film, they produced a small genre film called Run, Hide, Fight, which is basically what if Die Hard in a school shooting, which is a horrible idea on the face of it, but that was the type of content that they wanted to make. So it's very like pro Second Amendment, young girl in the middle of a school shooting, picks up guns and like fights back against the school shooters. And this film went around the film festivals. It got pretty lambasted for its horrible concept and not being a very great movie. The reviews were not good. But Ben Shapiro, looking to build a film distribution arm for his right-wing blog, made a partnership with Cinestate and picked up this movie and basically released it on their website, which is so weird to me. It's like, come to the Daily Wire to watch this movie and stay for, you know, weird right-wing blog articles. It's like they don't have any other media content. But Ben Shapiro being like this theater kid who's a failed screenwriter and went off and became like a right-wing propagandist for oil billionaires, he still has that dream of being able to do the movie thing. And he's trying to make it fit into his right-wing blog. And it's so weird. It's like the only place to go see it is on his website. And he's using that to push subscriptions to his website. And so what does he do? He immediately makes a deal with Gina Carano to produce and star in a film for The Daily Wire, which is going to be on their website. And to do so, he was like, pushes like, come get a subscription to The Daily Wire and get 20% off with the promotion code Gina. And it's just so weird. It's like, I'm looking forward to the movie that she does with Kevin Sorbo, you know, like God is Great 3 or whatever. It's like where she can play his terrified wife as Antifa is attacking them. It's like,
oh man. You know, the worst part is I hadn't seen anything on this movie, this Run, whatever it's called, Run, Hide, Fight. So I looked at the trailer, and it actually, like, if you watch the trailer, it doesn't look completely terrible. But how did they, like, I'm still shocked. Like, the pull quotes actually make it look like a good movie. Which is so depressing.
Yeah, and it's got depressing. Some real actors in there too. It's got Thomas Jane. It's got Radha Mitchell. It's like they're barely in the movie. They play like the parents that you see in like the opening, and for the most part, it's just the kids in the school itself. But they managed to like suck some you know real names into this movie. It's like whatever, you got to work. You know, work is work. At the same time, it's like if you. Like, because Daily Wire did, like, a whole bunch of promotion. This included, like, releasing a whole bunch of, like, behind-the-scenes interviews. It's, they all kind of look like they're really trying to, like, shine a turd with their involvement in this film. They're trying to say stuff that's nice, and they don't have anything nice to say.
Nice to say. Oh, man. Okay, you have to enlighten me, because I had never heard of the Daily Wire. This is how disconnected I am. So, because looking at the website, I couldn't tell. I know they have a podcast that has like 1,000 episodes, but is it like a news website or is it like, what is it exactly?
Yeah, it's a news website. It's just like Breitbart or the Daily Caller or any of these like right-leaning blog sites that just like pick up a news story and then do like heavy right-wing spin on it and regurgitate it out and then use their SEO to sort of game the algorithms on Facebook and whatnot and spread disinformation to your racist uncle on Facebook and further radicalize him into becoming, you know, a fascist. That's exactly what this site is. And his you know, podcasts and show is exactly the same. And Ben Shapiro got kind of infamous for a while for going around to college campuses and doing like speaking tours and all these like, these students without any media training would challenge him on questions and they do the thing where it's like, oh, well, it's like Ben Shapiro is going to have his assistant holding the mic for the person answering the question so they can yank it away the second it gets too hot. And then Ben, who can talk really fast, will just say something like, you know, say a lot of words for like 5 minutes and make the student look stupid. And then they put it up on YouTube. Ben Shapiro destroys leftist student. And it was always like embellished with this ridiculous kind of hyperbole to it. Where it's like, he was never just debating someone or answering or explaining or, you know, even winning an argument, it was destroys, it was obliterates, it was annihilates. It was like everything to him, his whole attitude that he conducts everything with is that politics is downstream from culture. And so everything about him is culture war. If there's a movie with a woman in it, this is the worst thing possible because this is culture war. And the politics will extend from that. And so it makes sense that he's breaking into movie distribution because that's part of his whole ethos. It's trying to generate the culture that the politics will follow downstream of.
Ugh. Ugh. The drama. Oh, man.
I feel really bad because, surprisingly, you did not know who Ben Shapiro was before this. And now I have, like, taken someone who is blissfully unaware, and I have now ruined you, and I feel horrible for that.
Well, no, don't, because I mean, the reality of it is that it's good to know what's out there, and to, even if you don't interact with it on a regular basis, to be aware of it. So now I'm aware that this douchebag is out there, and I can continue to avoid it blissfully. It's all
exactly,
fine.
Exactly. You gotta know. Fine. You gotta know who these people are and what their motives are.
Oh, exactly, exactly. But let's cleanse the palate. Let's cleanse the palate with lots and lots of blood. The Mortal Kombat trailer dropped the other day. I was like,
Mortal Kombat trailer.
So this is the, like, I was like, there's another Mortal Kombat movie? Wait, didn't they do this like a decade ago? 2 decades ago? Like, I don't even remember when the last one came out. But then I watched it. I'm like,
95, I think the first one came out. Oh,
man. But you know, I gotta tell you, I watched that trailer and I was like, I will give these people my money. I will definitely watch this movie. I don't know why, but I have like this soft spot for Mortal Kombat and I don't understand. I've never played the game, but there's just something about it. I don't know.
It's I'm excited to see it too. Although I've always sort of questioned if you can even have a quote unquote good Mortal Kombat movie. But whatever the best version of that movie is, it kind of looks like this movie is probably it. It feels like they understand what the real kind of like selling point that people go in for the games is. And, you know, it's basically the fighting and the gore. That is it. Mm-hmm. And it looks like they're doing some really creative stuff that's in there. And it's also really interesting to me because the game originally, which like came out in like the 80s or early 90s, I can't remember exactly when it hit arcades, but it was essentially like Bloodsport the video game, and the character of Johnny Cage was even modeled to be Van Damme, and they wanted Van Damme because it was one of the first games where they actually like filmed live actors and then digitized it to do the moves, and they wanted Van Damme to basically be Johnny Cage in the game, but he turned it down. So that was always sort of the intention. They were making Bloodsport, but because it's a video game and has over-the-top stuff, and Street Fighter was a big deal in arcades at the time, so you have things like people shooting fireballs, and the fatalities was the big thing that was like the selling point for the game at that time. It's also the sort of thing that made it one of the original sort of like video game nasties that sort of like caught the attention of concerned parent groups and politicians to say, wait a minute, maybe we need to start coming down hard on video games. So that just made it further catnip to kids. And as the series has progressed over the years, it's really interesting to see how like it's become more lore than anything. If they've just sort of like built this massive cast of characters and all this backstory and how these characters interact is basically a giant soap opera.
Yeah.
But with fight to the death kung fu and really gory kills. And there's nothing else out there that is like it. There's nothing to say, oh yeah, it's like Mortal Kombat. It's like, no, Mortal Kombat is singular. There's nothing else like it. And there was all the other movies that have come out for the most part haven't really captured it because they weren't really willing to create like the R-rated experience because it's a video game movie. It's for kids or at least all ages. So you got to tone that down to a certain degree. And it becomes, I know a lot of people like the 90s movie, but it's very goofy and campy. And the kung fu is not very good. And it's just like I'm not a fan of it. I'm a fan of the soundtrack, but I'm not a fan of the actual movie. But this looks like they've totally hit what Mortal Kombat is supposed to be. And it may be goofy, it may be over the top, it may be completely silly and without a story, and I'm still gonna watch it and I don't care.
I agree, and I think you're right. They've captured the gruesomeness of the video game. The trailer is brutal. And it's produced by James Wan. Like, That was shocking to me.
That honestly, that seems like a perfect fit to me, because you think like James Wan like really cut his teeth, kind of reinvigorating the horror genre, doing mm-hmm. stuff like Saw and then later the Conjuring movies, and Insidious, and also then going on to do Aquaman, which has become one of the most kind of celebrated DC films for just how kind of like good it is as like a superhero film and an action film, because it definitely has those elements, but also how campy and over the top and not afraid to go there it is. It has an octopus playing drums. It has people riding seahorses that neigh and whinny undersea. You know, it's like he like totally went for the brass ring on in that movie, and people love it for that.
Yeah.
And I see the same sort of attitude in this Mortal Kombat trailer.
Yeah, I fully agree. I'm really excited, and I'm really looking forward to it. It looks like a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Me too.
So now that we've talked about some of the stuff that, you know, we're excited about, what have you been watching? I know it's been a while since we've talked, so I'm sure you've watched a lot of things.
Oh my God, so much.
I know, it's like I talked to Dale a couple of weeks back, and it's like, yeah, we want the holidays for good movie watching time. They usually are. So what are some good things that you've seen that you would, you know, either recommend or tell us to stay away from?
Well, there's been a lot of really cool stuff that's come out very recently. And I even pared down my list, because otherwise this would go on forever with the amount of stuff that's come out since we recorded last. But first thing on my list, and this is probably the most recent thing that came out, is a movie called I Care a Lot, which is basically a modern noir thriller. And so this movie is directed by Jay Blakeson, who did The Disappearance of Alice Creed about 10 years ago, which was a movie most people slept on. But when I discovered that movie, I was so impressed by it. And it's like, oh my God, I'm going to watch everything this director does. And so when I saw that he did another movie, I'm like, oh, I am all over this. And thank God, because it is good, but it is also intense. So the premise of it is that Rosamund Pike is essentially a grifter. And her game is that she identifies senior citizens who don't have other people in their life and are financially stable and own their home and whatnot. And her company will basically go in and pay off their doctor to say that this person is no longer able to care for themselves, and get Rosamund Pike declared by the courts as the guardian over their lives. And then she will put this person into a senior citizen's home, where they are basically trapped under their care and cannot leave, while she sells off all their property for profit. So right there, it's like, she's a truly horrible person. And it was so difficult. I had to watch the movie in spurts, because it was actually bothering me so much. I was like, no, I have to take a break for this for a moment, because it seems too real. I have no doubt that there are people that actually do this, and it was very upsetting to me, especially as you see the person in the movie who she does this to, in particular Diane Weiss. And it's horrible watching this happen to her, and you just want Rosamund Pike to suffer for her crime so badly. And that's where the movie starts to twist, as you discover that Diane Weiss is not who she says she is. She is not just an ordinary old woman living by herself. She is actually the mother of Peter Dinklage, a presumed dead Russian mob boss who very much wants his mother back and is willing to do anything to get it. And so all of a sudden, Rosamund Pike has this problem where this mob boss is coming after her, and she is determined to stick to her guns and like get as much from this as possible. And it turns into a very juicy noir thriller. And it's such a weird tightrope, because every character in this movie is horrible. You kind of just want everyone in the movie to die, and yet the movie still works and is thoroughly engrossing. There's almost no chance that this movie does not end up on my top 10 list for the year.
Is it on Netflix or?
Okay, so in Canada, it is on Amazon Prime, but okay. I'm told by people in the U.S. that it's on Netflix there, but it's not okay. on Netflix in Canada. So I've actually never seen a distribution deal like that where it ends up on different streaming services in different mm-hmm. countries. But that seems to be the case for this one. So depending on where you live, it's going to be on one of those two services.
Okay, good to know. I actually did see this on like the new releases for the week, and I saw Rosamund Pike. I'm like watching it, so it's on my watch list. So I'm really happy to hear it's good. Oh, I'm excited. I'm going to watch that tonight, I think.
Highly recommended. So what's one of yours that you've been watching?
Okay, so I know you've seen this one. Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. And this title is like the kind of title where you like, I read it like four times and every time I'm like, what's that movie again? And then I remember and I'm like, somebody will tell me 5 minutes later and the name just doesn't stick. But people, this movie is on another level. it's so batshit insane in like the best way possible. I don't think I've laughed this hard. I don't remember when I've laughed this hard. It has been a long time. I literally was like bent over laughing on the couch. It was like the dance numbers.
The best way I've come up with describing this movie to people is it's like Romy and Michelle's high school reunion meets Austin Powers.
Yes. Yes, totally. And I think that that's what works. Like because that's exactly what I said to Dan. I'm like, this feels like Romeo and Michelle, like 20 years after high school reunion and maybe like after some drugs. Like, I don't know. It's just so crazy. So crazy. But I mean, it's just like, it just works. It's so charming and just so insane. You're like, yeah, of course that's going to happen. Of course there's going to be a talking crab. Why the fuck not? Why not?
Yeah, I absolutely love this movie too. It's like, oh God, this one might actually be on my top 10 too. It's been such an incredible month for movies. But I heard so many people talking about this film and I was like, what the hell is this Barb and Star? And then I finally watched it and I was like, oh my God, this may be the most perfect movie ever. Right. And basically, it's two Midwestern Nebraska 40-year-old women played by Kristen Wiig and Annie Mamola who lose their job and decide we're going to go on a vacation to Florida. And the whole time, you know, they're just like very ordinary, like, so, you know, kind of flighty, but at the same time, just like very, very straight edge type women. They're just like, oh yeah, that's like real good. It's like a character you would picture from the movie Fargo.
Yes.
And they go down there and they run into Jamie Dornan, who is there on behest of an evil James Bond villain, also played by Kristen Wiig, who wants to murder everyone in Del Mar with basically poisoned mosquitoes.
For reasons.
Yes. And he's there to make sure that it goes off without a hitch. And he ends up basically going on a big drug trip with Barb and Star and ends up in a threesome with them and loses the microchip he needs to complete his mission. And so while they're both fighting over Jamie Dornan,
I totally believe that as a thing that would happen. It's Jamie fucking Dornan. I believe it.
I know. And it's like it's crazy because like I've never really been particularly enamored with Jamie Dornan. I know he had the role in the 50 Shades of Grey movies, which I didn't care about. And he was pretty good in that show The Fall with Gillian Anderson. But like Jamie Dornan is not someone who's been largely on my radar a lot, except as someone who's just like a generic kind of attractive guy. He's an attractive dude. And here he's being attractive dude as well. That's kind of his role. But yeah. He is also hysterically funny.
Yes.
He is funnier than I ever thought Jamie Dornan could be. And it's sort of like Chris Hemsworth when you see how funny Chris Hemsworth is. And it's like, why are you this attractive and this good an actor and this funny. It feels unfair that you should be all these things. And like, Jamie Dornan is legitimately funny in this movie.
Agreed. So great. I can't even remember the last time I watched credit sequence like in their entirety. Mm-hmm. I watched the entire credit sequence and it was completely validated by it.
Oh, yeah. Because
the credits are so funny.
Yeah. And it's just like a giant feel good movie.
It totally is.
You're going to laugh the whole way through, but it's got such a weird sense of humor where I can understand there's going to be people, maybe it's not their wavelength, because it's not just broad comedy. It is very out there comedy. It is not afraid to be as weird as you can possibly imagine, and then even a little bit weirder. And if you're not down for that, if you're not laughing on the level that it wants you to laugh at, then maybe you aren't going to have as good a time as we did. But if you're down for it, it's like by the end of the movie, I just had like the hugest smile on my face. And the theme of the whole movie is just like, you know, how great it is to have a best friend in your life. It's like, I saw someone tweet out today that they figure every bad review of this movie is someone who never had a best friend.
And I think like, that could love that.
That may be true.
And like, come on, we all need a soul douche.
Yeah.
That's got to be like the best thing I've ever heard in my life. I'm like, did they really just say that? Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
It's the type of movie that you will walk away with like a ton of quotes.
Yes.
You'll start to like drop into, you'll start saying the name Trish because of this movie. And the movie for it.
Oh man, so good. So good. So yes, Barb and Star, huge thumbs up from me and from you from the sounds of it. Which
yeah, awesome. Absolutely.
What else you got?
So another movie I watched, it's actually more of like a live performance. It's Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself. Now, this is available on Hulu. I had a few people recommend this to me, and I'm going to do the exact same thing that they did, where basically their recommendation was learn absolutely nothing about this, just watch it, and you will thank me. And that's kind of my review, too, but I'll try to be as descriptive as possible without actually ruining the experience for anyone. So this is a live off-Broadway show by Derek Delgadio, who's basically part of like an actor's troupe that essentially incorporates magic performance and sleight of hand into what is essentially like stage performance. So while it's not a magic show, it has magic that's sort of incorporated into the narrative of it. And so this whole thing was filmed over a series of live shows and cut together by Frank Oz, who's infamous director who everyone should know and is incredibly pedigreed. And it is possibly one of the most transcendent emotional experiences I've ever had in my entire life. And I don't say that lightly. And I say that in a positive way. By the end of the show, I was sobbing uncontrollably and just like so emotional, but not because I was sad. It was more just like an emotional release. And it is so affecting. And I don't care who you are, it is probably going to affect you too, because it gets the heart of the sorts of things that affect every single person. And it was just an incredible singular experience. So I cannot recommend it more highly, and I think everyone should watch it. And I don't want to explain more, and it's solely because the more you learn about it, don't watch a trailer, don't read anything about it, because the more you know about it, the less affecting it will be for you. And I feel like everyone should have that experience. I know this almost sounds like I'm pitching like a new wave cult or something like that. But it's not. It's just, it's an off-Broadway show. There's a ceiling here. But it is just like, it is so great. And I think everyone everyone should give this thing a shot. And most of the people I've talked to who have watched this thing, they have the exact same reaction. It's like you can walk into a room and say, have you seen In and of Itself? And they'll be like, that one person is like, oh my God, I need to talk to you about it.
Okay.
And everyone else is just like, what's happening right now?
I had a... Not, it wasn't a singular experience, but it certainly was an experience. We finally watched the Bee Gees documentary, How to Mend a Broken Heart, I think it's called. It's the HBO one.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh man, this documentary. I've been listening to the Bee Gees for 2 weeks nonstop.
Yeah.
Like, I was always a fan, but this doc is like, it's pretty good.
It's a very good documentary. I enjoyed it a lot, and I'm not even really a particular fan of the Bee Gees, but their story is genuinely interesting, mm-hmm. and it's very well put together, and I enjoyed it a lot. I think I walked away with a lot more respect for the Bee Gees and their place in music history.
Yeah, I think frankly,
they don't get mentioned alongside bands like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, but they really should be, considering where their place in music history sits.
I agree. And I mean, Frank Marshall is no slouch. You know, he's a good filmmaker anyways, mm-hmm. but I really did appreciate the fact that they didn't shy away from the bad moments and the ugly moments as well as the good.
Yeah.
You know, you have to take everything in stride. And it felt like a really kind of all-encompassing, like the kind of final word on the Bee Gees, and I could appreciate that. I really, really enjoyed it, and I would highly recommend it, even if you're only a passing Bee Gees fan. I would say if you're only going to see one thing on the Bee Gees, this would be the thing to watch. And I'm sorry, I had no idea they'd written Islands in the Stream, which is by far, I will argue with anybody, the greatest love song of all time. I never knew that it was the Bee Gees that wrote that, and now I'm kind of like, okay, and even more respect. Even more respect. Because that song legit is the best.
It's a great song.
It's an amazing song. So yeah, the Bee Gees doc, high, high, high recommendation for me. I was super, super pleased to finally catch up with it. Really solid.
Awesome. I recommend that one too. And I think, yes, it's a great final statement on the Bee Gees. And it kind of has to be, because I think it's like there's only one of them that's left alive at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, you know, the documentary is made up of like old footage that you haven't seen before, and then like interviews that are basically like the final interviews that, you know, various members gave before they died.
Yeah.
And so you get a good mix of like, here's interview footage and home movie footage from when they were exploding and probably had too big a heads that they had any right to have, and then also counterbalance with interviews from when they're close to the end of their lives and are able to have a more sobering retrospect on the history of their relationship with both the band and their brothers.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because that's the other thing. It was a band of three brothers, and they grew up together, and they, at the end of the day, they were still family. It wasn't just like a band breaking up. It was
the family
breaking up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, really good. Really good. What else you got?
So the next movie on my list is Synchronic.
Oh, I saw this.
Yeah.
I love these guys. I love these guys. They make really interesting movies.
Yeah. So the directors are, it's a director team. It's Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. And I first became aware of these guys probably about 2 years ago. They had they've been making really low budget, thoughtful genre movies for a few years now. But they came out with a movie called The Endless, which was a very kind of quiet, dramatic Lovecraftian horror film a couple of years ago. That was legitimately good and took kind of the genre of cosmic horror in a little bit of a new direction. It was a very, very solid film made on an incredibly modest budget.
Yeah.
And it got a lot of attention, and deservedly so, because it was a legitimately good movie. And they started to get a little bit more resources at their fingertips, and so they made Synchronic, which has Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan, which apparently Jamie Dornan month. I've watched two Jamie Dornan movies in the last 2 weeks, and that's more Jamie Dornan than I almost ever consume. So it's, I don't know what's happening. Apparently Jamie Dornan's time to shine. And this one, so I feel like the advertise is almost like a little bit misleading on this film, because just based on these guys' last film, and the way this film was pitched, I was expecting something that was a bit more in the cosmic horror arena. And it's really not a horror film at all. It is essentially a dramatic sci-fi time travel thriller. That's the best way I can describe it. Where Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan are paramedics, and Anthony Mackie stumbles across this street drug that is being sold, that is causing very weird stuff to happen, and people who are disappearing, people who are spontaneously combusting, people who, you know, are dying in extremely weird, unexplainable ways that they are discovering. And it all leads back to this street drug. And he manages to track it down and basically just, like, buy all of the supplies so no one can have it. And what he discovers is this drug actually allows people to time travel for 7 minutes. And it leads to some really interesting experimentation where he's taking the drug and trying to figure out, like, okay, how does this work? And it's like he finds out, depending on where you are when the drug kicks in, depends on what time you get transported back to. And it all sort of culminates in the quest to find Jamie Dornan's daughter, who had taken the drug and had disappeared and never returned. And so something has happened, and now Anthony Mackie, who has been diagnosed with, I can't remember what it was, brain cancer, and is dying, is determined, like, okay, I'm going to use this drug to track her down and bring her back. And that is his singular goal. And it ends up being like a very kind of emotionally rich and intriguing adventure into doing time travel in a way that I don't think I've ever seen it done before.
Yeah, no, and the theme of time travel is quite prevalent through a bunch of their movies, not just this one. It's not my favorite of their films. I think my favorite is still Spring, which if you haven't seen, you need to see. It's like on another level. But I thought it was a really, really interesting exploration of time travel. And like you say, I don't think I've ever quite seen it handled this way. And Anthony Mackie's, like, the way that they wrote the whole, the way that Anthony Mackie's storyline, as he's trying the drug and trying to figure things out and piece things together, the way that all comes together is just so interesting and so emotional. Like the thing with the dog, I was crying. I just wanted to cry. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really solid. I didn't love it as much as some of their other movies, but it's definitely like it's a great step up for them. I mean, they always seem to do so much with the little money that they have, but this one really does feel like it's like elevated. And yeah, the opening scene is like awesome. Mm-hmm. I love the opening scene of that movie.
Yeah, and they've definitely stepped up now because these two guys have been hired to make Moon Knight, so they've gone Marvel.
Yeah, it was only a matter of time.
Exactly.
It was only a matter of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I recommend that one too, and I think I'm kind of the same way, where I don't think it's my favorite of theirs. I have not seen Spring yet, so I'm definitely adding that to my must-watch list.
So good.
Because I do love these guys and what they're doing, and I definitely need to see that. I did like The Endless more, I think, and maybe it's just because I was expecting the horror to kick in Synchronic, because I feel like that's what had been promised to me, and it never did, And I felt a little disappointed. It's like, oh, all I got was a good movie, not a horror movie.
Well, I mean, because
I can't really complain too much, but it was not the film that I was expecting.
Well, and I mean, the reality of it is they've been working in the horror genre for so long that people, I think it's natural to expect that. And honestly, once you've seen their previous films and you rewatch The Endless, there is a whole new level of appreciation for The Endless. Because the callbacks to their original films are many.
Yeah.
Many. It's a really, really, really great movie that works on its own, but works even better once you've watched kind of the back catalog. So yeah, they're a great duo to kind of do a deep delve into. They make some really, really interesting films for sure. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm excited to see them working with a bigger budget and what they can do.
These
guys are clearly good storytellers and know what they're doing.
Exactly. So February is Women in Horror Month, and it's also Black History Month. So for Women in Horror Month, I kind of had this plan that I would do a revisit of a female-directed horror movie. I would do four this month, and I've only actually done three technically, because finding horror movies directed by women isn't so difficult. But then I decided that I was going to try to find horror movies directed by Black women, and that was like nearly fucking impossible. So there are some out there, but not nearly enough.
We still need Nia DaCosta's Candyman to come out.
This is what I was hoping for, and it still has not materialized. Yeah. So I did kind of tweak my little thing a little bit, and I thought, you know, there are other movies out there that kind of have Black women in lead roles. So like, where do I start? I'm like, I know. I'm going to watch Justin Simien's Bad Hair from last year, because it was a movie that I wanted to see and it had come and gone and I didn't get around to see it. So we watched it last night, and this movie is so good. I'm not really sure people have given it nearly enough credit. So Justin Simien is one of the co-writers of Dear White People. So he's got a lot of good cred, but this movie starts as like a legitimate like thriller, and then by the end of it, it goes really, really crazy, but the themes are so powerful that I think it still totally works. So the story unfolds in like the late 80s, early 90s in a radio station, in a TV studio that I guess would be kind of like BET, but like BET meets MTV, because they're like a music and culture show, the station. And it follows this young woman who is one of the executive producers, and the station is going through some changes. They've installed this young producer dude played by James Vanderbeek being a total douchebag. He's really good at it. So they've got this white guy kind of leading the station, and they've installed this new head played by, I can't remember her name now, but whatever. So now you've got this woman that's running the station, and she has a very clear vision for what's going to happen, and everybody's going to look kind of the same. And the concept is that basically all of the women that are on screen that kind of have like the traditional Black look, like with the afro hair or the braids, like they're no longer in fashion. And what you want is like the sleek hair, basically look as white as possible while still being Black and in the culture. So it gets into these like deep ideas about, you know, Black women and their hair, which is a concept that has been explored in many movies and many short films. And just, it's this part of the culture that I'm not really familiar with, but that clearly is important and is important for like self-actualization. And now you've kind of taken that concept and twisted it into this horror movie, and it gets at all of these different themes that are super important, but then it turns into this like really funny horror film with hair fights and hair wildly growing and hair that requires blood in order to stay shiny and smooth. It just goes fucking insane. And it's crazy. It's like legitimately nuts. And like by the end, you're like, this was like, this was actually kind of funny. But the fact is, the themes are still really good. So I still think Bad Hair, awesome. An awesome, awesome, awesome entry into like black horror. And it doesn't take itself super seriously, but it still delves into some like deep themes. So yeah, I highly recommend this movie. I really enjoyed it. And I'll be writing it up at some point, but it's good. It's very, very good.
That's awesome.
To see it.
One thing I just wanted to add, because this is something that has been kind of occurring semi behind the scenes. I've been sort of like part of the women in horror community for some time, working, you know, in women in genre film sort of arena in the film industry. And over this year, basically, there's been a lot of debate, and ultimately the decision was essentially to sort of broaden women in horror to not being part of a specific month, because it was always February that it was celebrated. And when women in horror was first sort of introduced as part of an initiative, it was for very legitimate reasons, because horror was very male-dominated film. It's still, male-dominated genre. It's still very much a male-dominated genre, but women have made very large strides into the genre in the last, like, 10 years since, you know, Women Horror Month has been a thing. And while the sort of outreach and attention is still needed towards female-directed films, it's also became increasingly important to recognize that women in horror should not really be competing with Black History Month. And that in and of itself was a little bit of a problem. And like you said, just trying to find horror films directed by Black women became really difficult, which just tells you that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that direction. So ultimately the decision has been made in the community. It's just like, okay, women in horror is like whatever month you want to talk about. It's every month of the year. It's like, this is our sort of like general, you know, battle cry to a certain degree. And February is for Black History, and we need to be celebrating that and pushing that forward, and pushing that forward outside of February as well. But it was about not trying to compete with something with a different marginalized group that was also seeking to have greater representation in a white dominated field. So two very important issues that should not be fighting for the same attention, but should be collaborating to lift each other up.
I fully agree. I mean, I just wish that I could, have found more to fit my bill, because I was really committed. I'm like, I'm going to try to find these horror movies directed by Black women. And I did actually end up watching Eve's Bayou, because it did come up on a number of lists. Not a horror movie by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know.
It's a good movie, but it's not a horror movie.
No, definitely not a horror movie. That's why I was kind of like, I've fallen off my bandwagon. I'm like, I need to try to make this work. I will say, in tying in, which is a good tie-in to Black History Month, Shudder has this – the only reason I ever subscribed to Shudder was because they have this documentary called Horror Noir, A History of Black Horror, which is like – the best documentary I've ever seen on Black horror movies. Definitely worth watching. I've since stayed a member of Shudder because it's super cheap, and the plethora of horror is so good. There is always something in there to watch. I cannot recommend it enough. For like $60. Best investment I've made.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Shudder is one of those things where I don't watch it all the time, but every once in a while, like, they'll have some exclusive stuff, or it's just, I want to watch a horror movie, and I'll turn on Shudder to see what they have. Yep. And it's nice to have it when I want it, as opposed to being a service where I just, like, I watch it all the time. And in particular, yes, the horror noir documentary series is terrific. I recommend everyone watch that. And that was produced by Phil Nobel Jr., who is also the editor-in-chief of the new revised Fangoria. Mm-hmm. And he's been very dedicated towards raising up minority voices. And they're also working on another documentary that is going to be on Shudder, which is all about queer horror, queer voices in horror movies. And it sounds like that is going to be really good too. I hear that Brian Fuller of Hannibal is going to be very much part of that series. So I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
He was on a podcast recently where he was talking about a long sort of bit that's in that documentary where they delve into the idea of Stephen King's Christine as a trans narrative.
Interesting.
And he made a very convincing argument, whereas I would not have seen it that way. But after listening to him, I was like, I get it. I get how this works. So I'm very much looking forward to that documentary when they release it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I love Brian Fuller. He could, as far as I'm concerned, he can do no wrong. So anything else you want to mention?
Yes. So another movie that I've watched, and this is probably one of the most contentious movies that's come out in a long time, is the movie Promising Young Woman.
Oh, yes.
It's one of those movies that was like set to come out right before the pandemic hit and then got pulled and had been basically sitting on a shelf for close to a year. And there's all these people who had seen it at festivals and were raving about it and sort of like really waiting for this bomb to drop on the public. And it just kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed. And finally it got released. And the bomb sort of hit. And it's one of those movies where it is a very divisive movie, and purposely so, where it's hard to argue that it's not a really good movie. But depending on how you feel about the movie and whether you feel the movie is right in some of the things that it's talking about is really where people are going to start to get separated, especially with the ending. So the premise is basically that Carrie Mulligan is a woman who, as a result of the trauma of not being sexually assaulted herself, but having her best friend be sexually assaulted in college, and that assault leading to her best friend taking her own life and dealing with the fallout trauma of losing her friend to that, has essentially fallen into a destructive, dedicated lifestyle pattern where she goes out to bars and pretends to be blackout drunk and waits for the nice guy to come over and say, I'll get you home safely. And he never does. He always takes her back to his place and usually tries to take advantage of her, at which point she sort of like steps back to sobering, to like cold, steely sobriety, and challenges these guys on their life choices and what would cause them to think that this was okay. And it's sort of intonated that she dishes out violence, but we're never really shown it. We just sort of see like this checklist that she keeps. And we get to see essentially like kind of a femme fatale character who is creating machinations to enact vengeance and emotional punishment on the people who were responsible directly or indirectly for her friend's suicide. And it culminates in a climax and an ending, which I'm not even going to pretend to slightly spoil, other than the fact that it is not what you're expecting. And personally, I loved the ending. I thought it concluded in such a fulfilling way that I couldn't have dream possible. And I think a lot of the divide is going to come between the fact that the movie is essentially serving two purposes. One is that it's a social narrative and that is talking about the way women are treated in society, is talking about sexual assault, is talking about consent, is talking about how there aren't punishment. There isn't really punishment for men who engage in repeated destructive behavior. And that it's usually women who bear the brunt of the result and the fallout from this sort of trauma and assault. It is on them to solve for themselves, and often they're just left to be broken and are failed by the system entirely. And on the other hand, it's also an exploitation film. At its heart, that's what it is. It yeah. is a noir thriller exploitation film, and it is also serving that purpose. And I think it did both really well. But it's also one of those ones where it's like everyone's going to have, I've seen some very, very kind of differing and insightful takes on where the movie fails and where the movie succeeds. And no two people are going to walk away from this movie with the same sort of take on it. And no one is particularly wrong with their take either, because it's going to be very personable. But it is a movie that will get people debating and arguing. And this movie will be talked about for like a good decade or more.
I think you're totally right. And I think that's probably the most important part of it, is the fact that it is a door opener for conversation, and conversations that need to be had, right? The one thing that, for me, because it is, you're right, I hadn't really thought of it as an exploitation film, but that is exactly what it is. And I think that's what's going to push people away, because some people will watch it and not understand that. And the violence, I think, is what's going to turn them off. And eventually they may just walk away from it as being this movie that's way too violent and something that I'm not going to watch. But I think they're missing out on the importance of what the director is getting at. What I thought has been interesting since the movie's release, and as Mulligan has been doing press, was the fallout that came from, I think it was a review in Variety or The Hollywood Reporter that made some comment about the way Carey Mulligan looked. And I thought that that was really interesting, because it is something that I think comes up in movie reviews all the time. It doesn't matter what movie it is. Sometimes it's a passing comment, and it all boils down to these microaggressions that people don't even realize that they're doing. And the fact that she called them out on it, I thought was brave and good for her. And the fact that they turned around and like, well, no, we didn't. It's like, it's right there on fucking the internet. Yes, you did. And the fact that you can't see that is an aggression is a problem. And I mean, I think those sorts of conversations that the movie gets at is like part of this bigger conversation that we need to have. And it all boils down to the fact that there just simply are not enough women in positions where they're reviewing movies for mm-hmm. these big things. I mean, why should a man be reviewing a movie like this? I don't think, I have no problem with it, but I honestly think that there is a conversation that a man is going to have after watching it that misses a part of the point, which he did in his review. And there's another side of the equation, which is, well, give us the female perspective on this.
Yeah, absolutely. The particular quote, and this is not going to be verbatim, but what he said in his review essentially is, there's Margot Robbie is one of the executive producers of the movie. And he said that he thought that Carey Mulligan was not necessarily the greatest fit, or she did not look the femme fatale part of the role, and that he could imagine Margot Robbie being a better fit for it. And it's like, he was clearly watching a completely different movie than I watched, because the movie, while she does kind of fit a kind of femme fatale role, she does so in a sense of how, if someone in real life were going to try to be a femme fatale, that's what they would be like. Not the imagined perfect femme fatale that you see in a movie. Mm-hmm. He wanted the movie version of it. And I think what most women see when they watch this movie. It's like, here's an ordinary woman dealing with shit, and this is how she's dealing with the trauma. That's ultimately what we're watching, is we're watching a woman deal with her trauma in a very destructive way. Mm-hmm. And how no one can really help her throughout the film. And that's ultimately the saddest part about it, is like, he was clearly expecting and wanting and watching a completely different film that he was entirely detached from. It had no greater meaning for him beyond being like a juicy kind of noir thriller. And there's a version of this movie that delivers that, but it's not as interesting, it's not as provoking, it's not a conversation starter. Yeah. It's just not the movie that it is. And he was not reacting to the movie on the movie's level. And that was a big problem. And unfortunately, to do so, he did it by invoking his displeasure with the appearance or assumed attractiveness of Carrie Mulligan as a woman in the film, which makes it doubly ironic, because the kind of what the film's about on some level.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. I've come around on this movie on various things, because the first time I watched it, I thought it was good, but I thought it was a little too much for, I thought the themes were too important to be dragged down by the violence of it. And the second time I watched it, I kind of had a better appreciation for it. I've now seen it 4 times, and I kind of wish I'd put it higher on my top 10 list, because I think it was either number 10 or just off the list. And I keep thinking, like, the more I watch it and the more time passes, the more I think that this is probably one of the more important movies that's come out in the last like 10 years, talking about women and empowerment and violence against women and how we deal with the fallout of that. And yeah, it's like this kind of movie that just kind of like festers and it's just like everywhere.
Yeah. And it's a tricky film, because essentially it falls in what you would call the rape revenge subgenre of films. But it handles that material in a way that no other film has really handled it. And I think it handles it in a way that all those other films wish they were handling it.
Yeah.
While it's not perfect, And there definitely are some flaws with it, and there's definitely some blind spots in how it's dealing with the material, I think it probably handles it in a much better, more interesting way than we've seen before.
Agreed. I don't have any more movies, but I will say this. Dan and I, we still watch Saturday Night Live pretty regularly, and some weeks are better than others. And I will just say this. So Rene Jean-Page was on this past week, of course, the star of Bridgerton. And it was probably one of the funniest SNLs in a long time. And I've started to realize, like, I've never been a regular watcher of Saturday Night Live, but as we've become like more accustomed to watching it more regularly, I've discovered that when the guests aren't very good, they may be only in one or two skits. Mm-hmm. And then when the guests are really good, they're in every skit. He apparently was really good. And if nothing else comes out of that episode, the Loco song is probably the best pandemic song that I've heard since the pandemic started. And I'll just leave it there.
I think nothing will reach the pinnacle in what I believe was like the mid-90s. When
Dick in a Box?
No. Dick in a Box was much later. I'm thinking in particular when Steven Seagal hosted the show. In terms of, you're talking about when guests are not good on the show. Probably the worst guest host they've ever had on the show was Steven Seagal. He could not read his lines. He did not know how to do live comedy, much less comedy of any kind. He was so out of his element, and the show is a total train wreck. It is painful to watch, but possibly in the best way you can think of.
So one to Google search for sure. I love it. Anything else before we wrap up today?
Not really. I mean, like, I'm sure, like, everyone else, like, I'm currently, like, very deep into WandaVision, which is going. But I think we should probably, I think there's, like, 3 episodes left. I think we should probably wait until the end of the series before we dive into that one.
Yeah, let's do that, because I'm very confused.
Yeah, I'll have a lot to say on WandaVision, and I think it's probably better to save that for the end.
Okay, sounds good.
I will say, however, one thing that I do hate about WandaVision is, like, every Friday at, like, 12:01 a.m., it's like I need to delete my Twitter app because people will start spoiling the show immediately. People cannot wait to spoil that show. And we've been doing regular watch parties with friends where we watch it Friday evenings. And so it's like I have to, like, remove Twitter for a day just to, like, not have the show ruined for me. And, like, why are people like this? I hate it. I hate it so much.
Oh man, I'm very lucky in that, you know, I'm so busy I can easily avoid going on Twitter for a day, so I generally don't get spoiled. But immediately after the show, it's like, what just happened? What was this today? So I always do the post WandaVision Google.
I've been trying to stay as blissfully ignorant as possible, which is becoming increasingly difficult to do because I mostly just want to be surprised by the show. So I know there's, like, a lot of, like, pre-existing material, some of it which applies, some of which doesn't, because it's largely based on, like, the House of M comic series. But, you know, in like, which I have not read that series, but also what happens in that series doesn't really apply because some of those elements don't even exist in the MCU yet. So it's a little bit of a grab bag of everyone trying to figure out or get ahead of the curve of what's going on.
Yeah, no, it's definitely fun. We've been enjoying it too, but that will be a discussion for sure, because maybe you can educate me on some of the stuff that I've missed, because I'm sure there is a lot.
For sure. Absolutely.
But with that, we'll wrap it up here. Come on by atcpod.ca, check out links to all the stuff we talked about today. I will on purpose not link to In and of Itself. I will just list it, but we'll no links to anything. But stay tuned. We'll be back in hopefully not another month. It'll be a little more regular. Definitely for the end of WandaVision. It's going to happen. So until next time, we'll talk soon.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.